Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, wonderful audience, and do not forget my newest book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. It really can help liberate you to have a happier, more loving, more effective 2016. It's my wisdom, at least, if you want the sort of the sum and the essence of what I've learned about living this fascinating life I've had, full of fear, danger, excitement, love, loss, gain, creativity. I've tried to communicate about some of what I think is important in having a good life. Today, my guest is someone who has one of the most exciting, worthwhile, valuable, loving, intelligent, intellectual, creative, caring lives I know of.
Oh, wow. Are you there? Thank you.
Are you there, Joanne?
I'm here.
I'm talking about a guest that I've had on once or twice before over the years. And in recent times, I've been thinking about having my favorite folks on more often. I mean, the big TV shows, they got the same people on every day that they like. So I'm gonna start having the occasional person that really matters in my life on more often. And this is Joanne Cacciatore. Joanne's name is spelled exactly like that, the delicious Italian cooking, Joanne Cacciatore. She's from Arizona. She's created the Center for Loss and Trauma. Joanne has been to my conferences and spoken there, and she invited me to speak to hundreds of people at one of her conferences in Arizona. And Joanne works with people that few other people want to work with. People who have had severe, unexpected, traumatic loss of loved ones, often unborn children, newly born children, grown children. I think that's among your largest group, isn't it, people who have lost their children?
Yeah, predominantly. So many parents lose their kids at different ages. And, you know, in the literature, the death of a child is universally classified as traumatic because parents don't expect to outlive their children. So, most of the people I work with have either their children have died or their children are dying.
Now, if you want a quick glimpse of a profound human being, go to Joanne Cacciatore's Facebook page and click on the story of, and help me pronounce it, Chimako?
It's Chimako. Chimako. It's a Pima word. And they just need to go to Facebook and look up Dr. Joanne Cacciatore, and the video will pull up, yep.
And or Google it, and you'll get it, too. And it's a video of the story of Joanne going for a hike that she'd wanted to go on for a long time, mm-hmm. as if she were drawn onto it. And she's on it for 5 minutes, and she comes across a terribly abused and dying horse. And the video is about, very positive, about the saving and the loving of that horse and the love in return. Mm-hmm. I think that horse really affected you, well, I know, deeply, and maybe added something new to your life. Is that so?
It is so. I've never owned a horse before. We live in Sedona, and I do have horse property, but we've never had a horse. And we were hiking on the trail, and the reason I guess I should preface it by saying the reason I got into this work 2 decades ago is because I myself suffered the loss of one of my children, my young baby daughter. And that was in 1994. And so I'd always wanted to hike this trail. This, you know, we're fast forwarding 21 years later. And some friends invited us to go. They had been on the trail before. And, you know, I'm an animal lover. I think you remember this about me. I've been a vegan for a long time, and I've been a vegetarian, haven't eaten an animal since 1972. So I'd always loved animals, but never owned a horse and rescue dogs and such. But so we went on this trail, and we were probably 5 minutes into the trail, and we come around the first corner, and my friend who's with me, who knows how I feel about animals, is turned around facing me, and she looks a little like she saw a ghost. And I said, "What's wrong?" And I looked around her, and I saw a horse that had fallen. He was being used as a pack animal, and he had many, many tents and backpacks and all kinds of luggage on his back that he was carrying back up out of this the place where people were camping at the bottom of the canyon. And there was a man who wasn't, let's just say, wasn't being very nice to him trying to get him up, but the horse was bleeding on his knees and in his face. And I, at first, I just didn't even realize it was so out of context. I'd never seen anything like that happening. So I yelled at him to stop hitting the horse, and then started to cry because I'm a sensitive person. And as soon as I started to cry, the man took the other, I think there were five or six other horses with him, and he took them back up to the top of the trail. And this horse was on the ground, and we took his packs off of his back because he was barely breathing. I mean, he was really in a bad way. But I didn't know what was underneath the packs because his whole back was covered. And so when we took the pack and the saddle off, we saw that he was completely, utterly emaciated. I mean, very, very near death. His hip bones were coming through his skin. His spine bone, the vertebrae of his spine were coming through the skin. I've never seen anything like that. And my head kind of spun, and I became very emotional and went to sort of comfort the horse, and he flinched as if I was going to hit him. And, you know, I looked in his eyes, and it was a moment of real deep connection and oneness with an animal. Even though I'm a human being and he was an animal, he knew suffering like I knew suffering 21 years earlier. He was close to death like I was 21 years earlier. And I looked in his eyes and I said, "I'm going to get you out of here. I'm going to get you out of here." And it's the story of how I did it, how I got him out, and his recovery and overcoming many labels that people put on him because he is a stallion. And he's not just a stallion, but he's a traumatized stallion. So there were all kinds of labels that people had foisted on him, that he would be dangerous, that he would hurt me. And I really couldn't listen to those things. I really had to let my heart guide me. I promised this horse I was going to help him, and I did. And I still have him. He's fully recovered. He had ended up having back surgery. His wounds were pretty significant. We tended to his wounds quite frequently for the first few months. And now he's doing great. I hope people will go and watch the video, because it's one of those videos where you feel so many different emotions, and you're crying for sad tears, and then you're crying happy tears, and he's such an inspiration, and has certainly given to me as much as I've given to him, in terms of seeing how we're all connected, and how the suffering of any other being, if I can help to ease, it is my duty and my responsibility. So, yeah, I'm glad you got to watch it.
I can't exaggerate the quality of the story as it's filmed. Not just, of course, the spirit of Joanne Cacciatore, but of other people and the filming. And the music in the background was particularly moving to me.
Yeah.
There's a song in there that I'd never heard before about, sung by a woman about you know, I'll take care of you when things get tough. Do you know what you know the song I mean?
I do. It's a song by a Christian band, a band I really love called J.J. Heller, and it's a song called Keep You Safe. And the first time I heard it was, I think, right around the time I rescued Mako. I call him Mako. It's a shortened version of his name. Right around the time I rescued him, and I just wept and wept because I told him I was going to help him and keep him safe, really. And so it really spoke to me, and that's one of the reasons I wanted that for the video.
Now, in that song, since it's in the background, I didn't get to replay it and have the time and listen to it more. But is that supposed to be the woman singing about Jesus, or is she singing about herself, or both?
I don't know.
It was so touching, and just to be a teeny bit personal, it just reminded me of sometimes how Ginger, when I'm in distress, just loves me and takes care of me, and it was, and how I want to be with her. And of course, as you know, she's had an unfair amount of distress physically in her life. It was just very, very touching, and it's a wonderful introduction to you as a person. And I'm just really glad and touched to have you back on the show. I'm almost, I don't know, I'm just having a lot of feeling about hearing your voice again and talking with you again. Joanne, you know, there's so many ways we can move on from here. You were thinking about talking a bit about grief in general. I think grief is maybe one of the bases of life. The more I think about it, and I haven't thought about it this way at all, actually, until this moment. But the fact that we grieve, I think I've never thought of this, Joanne, is much more important than the fact that we die. I think we're much more afraid of loss than death.
I know I am. I think you're right. And in fact, you know, it used to be, you know, 10 years ago, everyone was talking, we have to talk about death more. We have to talk about death. Certainly, we do have to talk about death, of course. But I find that people talk about death much more easily than they talk even about grief. Because we don't know what to do with painful emotions. We're a culture that promotes and promulgates this idea that everyone has to be happy all the time, and, you know, kind of the perils of positivist psychology pushed on people. And the reality is that life hurts at times. It's also beautiful, but it also hurts, and we have to be able to be with one another when it hurts too, not just when it's good. Because that's when it counts. Those are the friends you know are true friends, those who stay with you when you're hurting. Everyone wants to be there when there's a party. Nobody wants to be there when there's tears. And so there's some real value in learning how to be with our painful emotions, with human suffering. And unfortunately, our culture doesn't teach this well. In fact, we teach the antithesis of that. We teach to avoid suffering and pursue happiness at all the costs, including cost to ourselves in terms of distractions, drug addictions, alcohol abuse, you know, gambling, pornography, all the distractions that take us away from our painful pain and suffering. Does that make sense?
Well, of course, and I don't think you specifically mentioned, but I know you think a lot about, which is why you had me speak at your group, psychiatric drugs. That idea now that you've talked a lot about, and so have I, of calling grief depression and treating it with drugs to satisfy the greed and stupidity of industry and professionals. That's really become the big escape now. I mean, if a woman is sad over the death of her husband, she's going to be on an antidepressant one day later or even the same day from her GP.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Jeff Lacasse and I actually published a paper a few years ago where we looked at bereaved mothers, and we have, you know, almost 4 out of 10 bereaved mothers being prescribed psychiatric medications, many of them within 48 hours after their child has died. you know, it's baffling to me because it revokes, in a sense, the dignity of human emotion, the most important human emotion, which is grief. But when we do that, we simultaneously nullify love, because we love because we grieve because we love. And so the only way, it's been 21 years since my baby daughter died, but the only way that I will ever be able to say I'm done with grief is when I'm either dead or when I'm done loving her. You know, and because my love endures beyond death, I'm going to grieve, and that's okay. I'm okay with that. I don't need to not grieve her absence in my life. But we're just so, I mean, we really are dualistic minded, wherein we either explicitly or implicitly send people messages that you cannot be in grief if you're going to be happy, and you can't be happy if you're going to be in grief. And that's not true. Those states can coexist. I am a very happy and content person in life, and yet I probably cry at least 5 times a week, not necessarily because of my own grief, sometimes because of, for example, a horse I find, or somebody else's pain, somebody sharing the pain of loss, the loss of their child. You know, and so this idea that we cannot be happy and sad simultaneously is a myth. It's a myth that's perpetuated by a culture that's obsessed with hedonism and happiness at all costs. And unfortunately, what it's costing us is authenticity and, you know, genuinely open and intimate relationships. That's my feeling.
Oh, you're saying it so well and so importantly. You can't have love without eventually having to face grief. They're so intermixed. There's no way around it. Golly, I'm almost a little speechless here just thinking about this. Loss, grief defines us in many ways as being human beings. Now animals can experience loss and grief. Dogs grieve when their masters or their humans go out for dinner. Mm-hmm. They experience loss. But for us human beings, it's such a deep part of us. I've been reading more and more about the evolution of human beings, and, you know, probably 100,000 or more years ago, we were burying loved ones with their tools, their clothing,
oh, yeah,
with food.
Yeah, Neanderthal rituals were very, you know, proscribed in their culture. Yeah, absolutely.
And we need to really, really accept that there isn't any way to escape the grief of loss, anxiety about loss, resentment about loss, because we can't even escape it by not having relationships or having shallow relationships, because then our whole life becomes a loss.
Right. So and you know those kinds of people. You've met those kinds of people, though, haven't you? Those kinds of people who are so governed by fear instead of love, because fear of loss, that they protect themselves to the extent that they really aren't intimate with anyone. Like, they don't really have any genuinely close, meaningful relationships. And those are the people who, you know, live these sort of, you know, sad, really kind of superficial lives. And, you know, that to me is an even greater tragedy, to have had a life that way, to be on my deathbed when I'm 80 years old and to say that I was too frightened to let myself love and lose. That's a little too small of a life for me. I don't want that. And you don't want that. Most people don't want that. Most people want to be able to connect with others, to have intimate, loving, meaningful relationships with others, even if it means that the price we're going to pay for that someday is grief.
I mean, I agree with you so much. I don't want to talk too personally, but you know, I had a series of just profound losses when I was 5, 14, and 20, and it wasn't till Ginger in my 40s that I got rescued from that. And I was depressed that during that time. I tell my my patients, I'm living proof that you can be depressed until you're a grown man and you know, just get past it and have a rich, loving life. You can't avoid grief, but you're going to have such a rich and loving life. And we all go through losses, and if we don't go through severe ones, we imagine going through severe ones. There's just no escape from it. We've got to take on that issue in order to live as fully as we can. And you know, love is the is to me the epitome or the high point of love, and loss is the high point of pain. Grief is the high point, the deep point of pain, and human beings go between these feelings, and often in my experience, when a person relives their grief and experiences it especially intensely, those can often be moments of growth. Where, because I think grief gets re-stimulated sometimes later in life. If we think about loving again, say you've lost your wife, or you've lost your child, and maybe through death, maybe through terrible rejection or your own bad mistakes or because you were an alcoholic or whatever. And then later in life, you meet someone to love, or you find something like the horse to draw the love out of you, or work or creativity. You may have to face that grief again, because if you don't deal with it, it will stand in the way of your growth. And so, folks who are listening, you know, if you start falling into grief again, you may be near to loving again. Does that make sense to you? I don't know how you think psychologically about those things.
My experience with the population with whom I work is that I call it re-grieving, and I think it happens all the time. I mean, it happens certainly in the first few years on special days, you know, a special song, a smell, you know, even, you know, the cereal aisle in a grocery store can incite, you know, kind of re-grieving, an episode of re-grieving. Once the initial acute grief has sort of quieted a little bit. But I think it's something absolutely can endure for decades, and I think it's a perfectly normal thing, and I think self-awareness is the key, just knowing yourself well enough to know and understand this regrieving is normal and okay, and to learn to stay with it rather than have to leave it, like you're saying, you know. I mean, because a lot of times what we do is we have an uncomfortable or a painful emotion that arises in us, and rather than stay with it, we distract. And like I was saying earlier, certainly we can distract with substances and gambling and porn and some of the what are socially unacceptable ways of coping with pain. But we can also distract with things that are more socially acceptable. And, you know, I'm going to invite people to consider maybe selective distraction is okay if it's a healthy distraction, but maybe we need to learn how to sit with it and be with it and see what it has to say. I think you kind of said it just a few minutes ago where he was saying, you know, it can be a moment of growth. Most certainly, we don't grow when we're comfortable. We don't. When we're comfortable, everything stays the same. We grow when we're challenged. We grow when we come to a place 10 years after the death of a child and something really touches a soft place in you and you know, oh, that's grief again. Grief is reemerging. I'm regrieving. That's when we grow again. It's constant growth as a human being, unfolding into who we are to become as we leave this earth ourselves one day. So, it makes sense, and it's what I see every day in the people with whom I work.
Now, are you still sort of an open house for grieving people around the world, or have you, of necessity, because I've certainly backed off a great deal from how much I can handle from the outside world wanting to communicate with me. How are you handling that in your life now?
It's constant balancing act, you know, because my paying job is that I'm an associate professor at Arizona State University in the School of Social Work. So that's my paying job. And I have, you know, I publish research. Then I run the MIS Foundation, a non-profit group. And then I do training. And one of the reasons that we started the provider training program, it's an intensive training on traumatic grief specifically, is because I can't possibly see all the people who want to see me from around the world. I just had a family last week from Italy here for the week. Before that, it was a family from Paraguay. There was a family from, Canada. So, I mean, people shouldn't have to travel that far to find someone who understands traumatic grief. So we do the 4-day program to train people how to work with families so that we have people in their area that they can find and connect with who understand what they're going to do and who aren't going to pathologize their grief, because this is what happens. You know, it's been 3 weeks since your 8-year-old son was murdered, and you're expected to be okay. And that's not okay. It's not the griever's fault. It's the culture. It's a sick culture that expects people to feel okay after something so traumatic and tragic can happen to a person and to a family. So, you know, the idea is to get more and more and more people trained to understand that this is not pathology and how to really hold space for people who are traumatically bereaved in a compassionate, mindful, and really connected way. Even being able to face their own anxiety and fear that arises when we feel so vulnerable in the face of such a horrible story as a provider. I mean, if you're a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, and you get a new family, you're working with a new family whose little child was murdered in her school, and you have a child the same age, you're going to have some feelings of vulnerability. And so what that means for our providers is we talk about self-care and self-awareness and cultivating a state of self-awareness and not letting fear get in the way of the relationship and what to do with our own emotions around such terrifying loss. All really important and all, frankly, lacking in the pedagogical models of many university degree programs, as you can imagine.
Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. I think I jiggled my microphone. What sorts of people do you take into your training program? I think there may be people listening who would love to learn about whether they qualify or can afford or want to join your training program.
So if people are looking to find a provider who understands traumatic grief and has been through the program, it's certificate.missfoundation.org. So you can put in a zip code and you can find a provider who's been trained in traumatic grief. Many of our providers have actually lost children themselves, and now they're an LCSW or a psychologist, even a psychiatrist, nurses, physicians, you know, all kinds of providers, even funeral home directors, even yoga instructors. Because for a yoga instructor, a lot of people are turning to yoga and alternative modalities, but, you know, getting back in your body is a terrifying, terrifying thing to do without appropriate support if you've had trauma. And so it's important for even yoga instructors to understand how to kind of gently treat people who have experienced traumatic grief. So, and then the next program, I think, It's the end of March. It's a four-day intensive program, so people can read more about it if they're interested. It is intense. It's very intense. I think we've had 7, 8 cohorts now, I don't think there's been a single person in any cohort that at some point did not cry and get emotional during the training. And that's okay. You know, that means that they're really empathizing deeply with the information. It's not just they're feeling it. They're not just thinking it. That's what I need them to do. I need providers to be willing to open their hearts and feel with people, because that's where the compassion is born, in the emotions. And that's a really powerful, powerful thing. I'm not a big intervention person. I'm not a big, you know, A, B, C, X, Y, Z intervention. I think the true healing, or whatever healing is to be done, happens because of love and compassion in a safe relationship. And unfortunately, a lot of grieving people today don't have many safe relationships.
Love and compassion in a safe relationship.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's it wherever we turn in life. If you want to be a minister or have a church that is good, it should be a safe place for love and compassion. You're going to be a therapist, if you're going to run a school, if you're going to be a good parent, if you're going to be a grown child, it becomes a good child to your grown parent. I mean, whatever direction you go in, if you want to have a horse or a dog, everywhere we go, if you want to write a beautiful poetry or a novel, we begin, I think, at our best with a safe place for love and compassion. I'm really enjoying this. I hope you're having a good time talking
always.
Today. You're a very spiritual person, but that word has such broad meanings. Could you talk a little more directly about your spirituality, whether you believe in a God or nature or love, and how it fits into your work and your understanding?
Yeah, I can try. Depends on the day. My spirituality is pretty fluid. I when I feel most spiritual, for sure, is when I'm helping, when I'm being of service to someone who's suffering, or even something who's suffering in terms of an animal. I will tell you, when I rescued Shimako, if there wasn't the presence of, you know, I don't know about Creator God. I don't know what that all looks like. But if there wasn't the presence of the numinous there, then I don't know where it would be present, because I felt deeply, deeply, inexplicably connected in a different dimension, in a different way. So it's when I'm serving those suffering, humans and animals, and maybe even Mother Earth, because I am sort of an earthy kind of person. But also, you know, when I'm out in nature. And so nature for me is a very important piece. I live in Sedona, so I do a lot of hiking. I barefoot hike, so barefoot hike is a mindfulness practice that I have. I take my shoes off and I hike barefoot. I don't do it in the winter when there's snow, and I don't do it in the summer when the rocks are so hot that they'll burn my feet. But I do it, you know, probably 8 months out of the year I can barefoot hike. And I connect with all things, the tree. I mean, I practice beginner's mind, which is part of my spiritual practice. Beginner's mind is this concept that, you know, every tree that I see, it's the first tree I've ever seen. And so, you know, I'm a little bit like a little kid sometimes, where I walk around and I'm in awe of things. I'm just always in awe of things. Look at the sky. It's so blue. You know, it may have been the same blue sky yesterday, but if I can approach this blue sky with beginner's mind, it's even more blue. And if I can approach this blue sky as if this might be the last time I ever see the blue sky, then how much more blue is it, right? I think that's one of the gifts of working in the field I work in, is that, you know, everything is richer, the colors are brighter, because I work so close to death and, you know, the ending of lives. And so here I am, you know, sort of in this place where I recognize that the fragility of every moment. And so, you know, beginner's mind really helps me practice a deep spirituality that I think is different from sort of a lot of spirituality today. I have a sangha in New York, actually, not far from where you and Ginger are. I think a couple of hours from where you and Ginger are. And, you know, and I have a zazen practice. I meditate, and that helps. That all of those things really help hone who I am as a person. And I think that's really important as a provider, because who I am as a person comes with me when I sit in a space with a parent whose three-year-old is dying of cancer. It's not EMDR doesn't walk in the room, ACT doesn't walk in the room, CBT doesn't walk in the room. I walk in the room and who I am as a person, and that's what's going to help the person sitting across from me. So my spiritual practice is really one that centers on, I think, probably two things, and that's suffering and compassion.
That was so, so lovely. Folks, you know, we're talking with a person who is really, really a gift to be with. And I hope you feel that same sense I do of what a gift you are.
Thank you.
On a different note, what's the difference between men and women about all this? I'm trying to remember when I went to your conference, I think there was a strong predominance of women. Am I right about that?
You are right. As you have in just about any kind of social science or social interaction experience that isn't around, you know, kind of the stereotypically male things, right? And so, you know, like in social science research, it's not unusual, especially in grief research, to see, or in any research for that matter, 90 to 95% of respondents are male. I mean, you know, are female. That's just the way that it is. Our conference is probably about 75% female, about 25% male. And so it's interesting.
And you know, I felt that, as I recall, I'm trying to get back into that amazing time. Let me say a little aside to the audience. You know, I have to tell this story, and then I want to. I'm at the conference, and I'm so nervous. I've never been, since I was maybe in my 30s, giving my first talks at the National Institute of Mental Health, maybe. I don't think I've ever been so nervous before giving a talk there. And it didn't have anything to do with Joanne. It had to do with the fact that I knew the people I was addressing had gone through some of the most profound grief on the face of the earth, on all of life. And so for the first time in decades and the last time ever, I wrote out a speech. And I was so pleased with it. Talk about denial. And Joanne came to visit with me before I gave my talk, thank God. And I said, look, I've written this out. And you looked at it. You got sadder and sadder looking. And you said, where's Peter? And so I dropped it. And I began my talk, talking as I've never had before, about, you know, a big loss when I was a child. And you just cut to the point with me. I mean, you just, you know, you just let me throw all that away and talk about what I was feeling. And while my loss was of a different kind, people appreciated it. It wasn't like anybody stood up and said, well, you didn't lose a daughter. It was appreciated. So just a wonderful group, folks. Anyone who wants to become involved, I think, is would just get so much from your affiliation with Joanne and the people around her. What I was thinking was that some of the men I met, I think, were also there because men often are when they quote, go for therapy, there because of their wives. Do you think men have a much more terrible time going through grief and hence often operate on a more superficial level?
Well, first, I should say it depends on the man. Secondly, I like to talk about it in styles. So there's a masculine grieving style and a feminine grieving style. Because I have worked with some women who had a masculine grieving style. It's not the most often, but I have worked with them. And I've worked with some men who have a feminine grieving style. There was a period where I was facilitating support groups down in Phoenix, and we had a dad who would come to support group every month for like 2 years. His wife never came. We never saw her. Just him, and he would sit on the floor and he would cry, and all the women in support group would just be like, oh, we wish our husband was like you know. So this dad got a lot of very positive feedback for his emotional expression. In fairness to sort of masculine style grievers in our culture, you know, we're not very good at tolerating even little boys' expression of pain or grief or sadness. You know, euphemism "big boys don't cry" is alive and well even in 21st century America. You know, there is that it's, even if it's not explicit, it's implicit in our culture that big boys don't do that. So if a little boy has been raised that way and socialized that way, then when he gets older and he loses his own child or his partner or his parent, then those same messages prevail. Big boys don't cry. So I work with a number of dads who have sat on the couch, or men who sat on my couch in my office, and they'll start to cry, and you could see them really trying to hold back those tears. And I don't say you can let it go. I just pretend like I don't notice, because I know that they're grappling with that. And oftentimes when they start to cry and let go, usually after they trust me, they'll apologize. I'm so sorry. And it's very interesting to me, because I think that there's this sense of I shouldn't be expressing painful emotions. Men do grieve. They just, let's say, masculine style grievers do grieve. They just grieve in a different way. And sometimes it's not recognized as grief. Similar with grieving children. Children absolutely grieve, but it may not look like the way that adults grieve. And, you know, let's take it down, let's siphon it down to an even more micro level. Even individuals grieve differently. So, you know, there are a lot of things that are similar, there are a lot of things that are different. What I know about the ways in which masculine and feminine style grievers kind of do things a little bit differently is the feminine style grievers tend to be a little bit more emotion focused, at least for a while. And they do tend to sort of review the details over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, I see this anecdotally all the time, and the research bears this out too. So, you know, they want to talk specifically. They want to go to the cemetery. Rituals are very important. They want people to talk with them about their child who died. The masculine style grievers are a little bit more task-oriented. They would rather do something. They would rather stay at work longer, take up a new hobby, you know, punching bag, running, something, some kind of oftentimes bodily expression. Both are normal, and both men and women move between them oftentimes. But we do see, at least clinically, I see more grieving mothers grieving in a feminine style way and more grieving fathers grieving in a masculine style way. But they mix it up too. So it's, I try to see people as individuals. It's very hard when you keep seeing the same emergent patterns, but I always, then I remind myself about beginner's mind, this idea that this tree that I'm seeing here, I've never experienced this tree before, and so I try to appreciate each and every encounter with every person as unique, and try not to let previous patterns influence the way that I think about the person who's sitting in front of me. Did that even answer your question?
Oh, these are beautiful answers. It's exactly how I feel, and how I try to approach friends and clients and so on. And to some extent, you know, but probably not well enough, my guests, I try to approach them in that same way. This is new. Who are you? Folks, it's the exact opposite of psychiatry or clinical psychology or whatever, where you have in your head a set of diagnostic categories and procedures with which to respond to the categories, and your work is to fit the poor soul who's come to see you into your category. It is literally the opposite. It's the difference between crushing somebody and helping liberate them, between putting them in a box, closing the box, and contracting the box, rather than opening the box and helping somebody climb out. You just expressed it very well. Tell me more about, tell us more about the grieving of children. Time and again, I hear in therapy, and I experienced this myself, not one of the even losses I mentioned to you, you know, without telling you about it from my childhood, but there was a time when a dear family friend died when I was probably a pre-adolescent. And I heard about it casually at a get-together of families, and no one had even told me the person had died. And I'm sitting at this dinner table, and I burst into tears that she had died. Yeah. And, of course, nobody knew what to do. I hear this all the time in therapy that, you know, grandma dies, and maybe you're closer to grandma even than mom. And nobody recognizes that as a child you're going through grief.
Right.
So share some of your knowledge and wisdom about children and their grieving and how to help them or approach them.
Yeah. So kids of all ages grieve. I mean, even in a sense, a 9-month-old baby, when a mother or a father, primary caretaker of a baby, puts the baby down at daycare for the first time and walks out of the room and that baby cries, in a very interesting sense, that's a grief reaction. That 9-month-old baby.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, we grieve when we lose. And so children grieve, they just express it very differently. So much of it depends on different variables. For example, things we have to consider about grieving children is the age of the child, but not just the age. Also the emotional maturation of the child and the cognitive maturation of the child. I've met some 7-year-olds who frankly are more emotionally mature than some 40-year-olds I know. That's another story. So, you know, when I'm working with a grieving child, what I do is try to assess, where are they on this list of all these different variables? What are the family dynamics? Is it open communication? Is it closed communication? Is it a very hierarchical family system, or is it a very democratic family system? There are many, many things that clinicians really need to consider working with grieving children. But we know that children do grieve, and that their grief often gets ignored because most children grieve in a way that we call intermittent mourning. And so what that means is you might have a 6-year-old, and I work with a little girl who is about that age, and her father completed suicide. And she would talk about how she missed her daddy, and she would cry about missing her daddy. And her mother would be comforting her, and then all of a sudden she would just pop up and say, "I'm going to play outside," and she would go play outside, and then laugh and have fun and play. And this really confused her mother, because her mother thought, is she faking that she's sad? Is she crying to put on a show for me? What's going on here? And oftentimes what we see with children is that they get to a certain threshold of emotional tolerance, and then they need to stop and do something different for a little while before they can return and reprocess in a way those emotions that they had earlier. So that in a very real, practical way, that interruption of grief is a break for them. It's giving them a little bit of a break, because the emotional heaviness just becomes too much for their little minds and little hearts to carry. And play is something that they do. And as far as I'm concerned, adults could learn a lesson or two about that, because sometimes when we're in a very, very deep state of grief, sometimes we forget to take care of ourselves. And so, you know, you see you're at the park and you're in a sad way. It's okay to go sit on a swing and swing your legs or get on the monkey bars and hang upside down, you know. I mean, children just have this really sort of organic rhythm that they're able to navigate grief if it's unhindered by the beliefs and values and wonky weirdness of their prevailing culture, which in the West is just, as it comes to grief, is just completely irrational and pathological. Our attitude toward grief is what's pathological, not grief itself. So for the children, the best thing that I have found is just to answer their questions in a simple and direct way. Let them express however they want. So sometimes when I was working with that young girl whose father completed suicide, she had a hard time sort of articulating the words. And so I got a huge box of crayons, one of those box, you know, 100 crayons. And I said, can you show me what color you feel like you are today? And so she would pick a color. That's how she would start our time together, was by picking a color. And she could express the color like that she felt that day. And then we would try to put words around that color. And so we need to really be very, very flexible when we're working with children, because there are so many different variables that will influence the way that they come to a grief experience. If it's the loss of a parent, it's really symbolic of the loss of safety in the world. And that's a huge loss for a child. And they don't even know at this point what that means for them in 10 years and 20 years and 30 years. If it's the loss of a sibling, then they've lost either a big brother or a big sister or a little brother, little sister. That also is a huge loss. In addition to that, mom and dad aren't the same people they were anymore. Things have totally changed in the family system. Parents who may have been once doting and attentive are now so overcome with grief that it's very hard sometimes to be present for your other children. That's why it's very important that the community stand in the gap. And, you know, and if it's a child who's lost a friend or a pet or a grandparent or a neighbor or anyone else, we need to provide, this is a really good opportunity for us to show children, to model for children what compassion in action looks like, right?
Oh, I just want you to keep talking. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left. I'll try to remember to glance at the computer to get some warnings from our wonderful engineer, Giselle, and see if I... Not Giselle anymore. Oh, my gosh. Jesse. There's grief. I miss Giselle, but Jesse's here. And we're getting to know each other better and better. You know, I think grief can, you know, that just reminds me that loss occurs in so many different subtle ways in our lives. And people handle it in such different ways. I have huge admiration, as listeners know, for Ginger's mom, Jean. And she's of the age where loss is daily.
Yeah.
She's making younger friends now because she's lost so many of her contemporary friends.
Yes. Yeah.
And she is such an interesting person. She doesn't share grief very much. I shouldn't talk much about her, but she doesn't share grief very much. What she shares is her love when we talk on the phone for all the people around her and all the things she's doing and caring about people and being busy helping survivors and helping older people like herself who aren't as healthy as she is. And she has, in the midst of what could be all this loss, she uses in part her Christianity, you know, her belief in the afterlife. Be interesting to see what you think of that. Her belief in the afterlife, her belief in a loving God, and her belief in being a loving person. And that has just given her a great deal of strength through what could be now, you know, a lot of grief. A lot of grieving, a lot of grief. Your thoughts, I want to get back to you. More thoughts from you about all this.
Which aspect?
Any aspect. I just want to hear you talk for a few more minutes. By the way, we are talking with Joanne Cacciatore, associate professor at Arizona University. Well, you know, could you in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, talk about your research? I mean,
oh yeah, that's not, talking about
my
research.
You're not just a clinician. Do you just tell us a little bit of what directions it goes in?
Well, I always study traumatic grief. Yep, I study various aspects of traumatic grief, ritual, culture, spirituality, mindfulness, etiology, epidemiology. I've just published my second and third articles with colleagues in The Lancet on perinatal death. Excuse me. So I have 51 published articles, and my articles always focus on traumatic grief. And so far, none of the research is funded. It's not kind of sexy research, but it's important research. And we've learned a lot of things. So, for example, one of the most interesting things that I found is that the provider's practice of mindfulness and self-care and full presence actually can protect the provider, him or herself, against vicarious trauma and burnout. So we train train providers in mindfulness and our model, which is the attend model of, you know, providing care for people. It's not a manual for caring. It's not an intervention. It's a framework. Attunement, trust, touch, egalitarianism, nuance, and death education. So it's an actual framework for the provider in approaching the clients. And so what we found was that this particular framework, which is built on a foundation of self-care and self-compassion, is protective, because most of the research suggests that when you work in a very, very highly emotionally charged field like this, you're at increased risk of burnout and vicarious trauma. Our providers who took the survey, who participated in the research, were actually protected against burnout and vicarious trauma, and also reported greater life satisfaction. That to me was super cool. I loved that study.
That is wonderful. I wrote an article for a book on burnout, and I said we just can't. You're just not right to assume that people burn out. If you stay loving the people you're working with, you'll never burn out. If you greet them as princes and princesses and treasures and, you know, and souls, you'll just never, never burn out. And I will never burn out on our relationship, which I wish to spend more time in with you.
Thank you, Peter.
Joanne Cacciatore, just with her name, you will find out a lot of what she's doing that's wonderful. Thank you for listening to this wonderful show.